Majors & Quinn presents
Manuel Gonzalez with John Giosio.
And tonight I'm really excited to welcome two really great writers to our store. The familiar and local favorite, John Giosio. He's a winner of the Loft McKnight Fellowship and is the author of three short story collections, the latest of which is Knockout, which is also very good. His work has been featured in a variety of places, including the This American Life, McSweeney's, and One Story. And again, he's local. He lives here in Minneapolis. And our guest of honor, Manuel Gonzalez, is the author of the novel The Regional Office is Under Attack. You have to say it that way because there's an exclamation point at the end. And the award-winning story collection, whose title I accidentally deleted from my intro, The Miniature Wife, thank you. A graduate of the Columbia University Creative Writing Program, he teaches writing at the University of Kentucky and the Institute of American Indian Arts. He has published fiction and nonfiction in Open City, Fence, One Story, Esquire McSweeney's Quarterly Concern, and The Believer. So tonight we're going to have John Giosio read first. Please join me in welcoming him.
Great. Thank you everyone for coming tonight. I am going to read a quick story from my book, Knockout. It's called Ackerman is Selling His Sex Chair for $10. It's a garage sale, and Ackerman is selling his sex chair for $10. It dangles from a beam in his garage. Underneath it, there's a set of cross-country skis and a bread maker. The sex chair is brown leather. I check the tag. It's Swedish. Very high quality. I inspect the various fucking holes. It's in great shape, very gently used. That's price to sell, Ackerman yells to me. I had a weekly thing with Ackerman's wife, Elaine, before she died. Every Tuesday night, we met at a motel and screwed. She kept on telling me she was going to leave Ackerman, but she never did. One Tuesday, Elaine didn't show up at the motel, and when I drove by her house a few days later, I saw a hearse and a bunch of people dressed in black. What happened? I asked one of the kids standing in her yard. Aunt Elaine crashed her car, he said. There are a couple of other people roaming around in Ackerman's garage, too. There's a young girl flipping through his record collection. There's an old guy rooting around in a box of tools. Ackerman's middle-aged, not much older than me. He's way too young to have lost a wife, but maybe too old and too sad to look for another one. That chair is going to go quick, he says. I wouldn't dilly-dally. Ackerman's right. There's already another guy eyeing it. I look at this guy and I can tell exactly what he's thinking. He's thinking about the chair's possibilities. He's thinking about where he could put it in his house, who he could talk into using it. He's not thinking what I'm thinking, how I miss Elaine so damn much that I stop by her husband's garage sale to buy something she once sat in or touched or that still held the scent of her shampoo. Before this other guy pulls out his wallet, I pluck the price tag off the chair and hand Ackerman my money. Sold, he says. Ackerman pulls the chair down from the rafters. Everyone else is gone now. It's just me and him. Grief isn't a contest, but suddenly I want it to be. I want someone to invent a grief testing machine and then hook both of us up to it so I can show Ackerman that I miss his wife way more than he does. You're really going to enjoy this chair, he says. What a normal person does now is says thank you very much and walks back to his car. This isn't what I do. Now that I'm here, I realize how badly I want to get inside inside Ackerman's house to see what other things of Elaine's I'm missing out on. The only way I can figure out how to do this is to pretend to faint. And so that's what I do. I roll my eyes back in my head and make my legs go slack, and down I go. Oh, shit, Ackerman says. I sit on Ackerman's couch and eat a banana. I assure him I'm fine, that this happens to me once in a while. Low blood sugar, I say. He hands me a glass of water and I drink it down. Lately, I've been listening to a lot of talk radio for company. I don't care what the topic is, sports or celebrity gossip or politics. I'm just really scared of it being quiet. I want to ask Ackerman what he does to fill up the silence, how he copes with Elaine being gone, but I can't let him know I'm anything other than a random garage sale pervert. Great house, I tell him. I look out the window into his backyard. There's a garden bed with some sweet corn and cucumbers. There's a patio with a fire pit. Elaine always complained about Ackerman being selfish, not paying enough attention to her, but he seems nice enough to me. You want to see the rest of the place? He asks. The last time I shoplifted anything was in high school, but each room Ackerman and I walked through, I shoved something of Elaine's into my pocket. A 5x7 black and white of her at the beach, a fridge magnet, a dart from the rec room. When Ackerman goes to take a piss, I slide into the bedroom and shove a pair of her panties into my pocket. I'm really sorry about all this, I tell him when he comes back. It happens, he says. It's not your fault. We're standing on his front porch now, staring out toward the street. A car slows down for a speed bump. It's a convertible full of teenagers. When they go over the bump, they bounce around, laugh their asses off. Ackerman stares at them, and I see tears form in his eyes. I understand how something insignificant can suddenly overwhelm you, how any old thing can dredge up a memory that knocks the breath from your lungs. You want to grill up some burgers? Ackerman asks. Sure, I say. Ackerman fixes me a drink, tosses the meat on the grill. We sit on the back deck and watch the sun slide down below the horizon. When Ackerman clears our plates, I run to the bathroom. I shove some fancy soaps and a hairbrush of Elaine's into my back pocket. While I'm there, I hear a glass shatter. Then another one. Then another. The shattering is spaced out enough that I can tell Ackerman hasn't had an accident, that he's doing this on purpose. When I get out there, he's already got the broom out. He's sweeping the shards into a dustpan. You okay? I asked. Just a little clumsy, he tells me. When I leave, Ackerman follows me to my car. I move in a measured way, weighed down by all of Elaine's curios. While I'm loading the sex chair into my trunk, that pair of Elaine's panties I stole accidentally falls out of my jacket pocket and onto the ground. I quickly kick them under the car and turn toward Ackerman to see if he's noticed. His lips have pursed and his eyes are held in a squint. He's not looking at me, he's gazing up at the clouds in the night sky. We should do this again, he says. Definitely, I say, offering a handshake. Ackerman lets my hand hang out there for a long time, but then he finally grabs it. I'm a hugger, he says, and before I can stop him, Ackerman pulls me into his body, surrounds me. I squirm a little at the beginning of his hug, wonder if he can feel everything else I've stolen from him pressing against his body. Wonder if he can feel the picture of Elaine, or maybe the dart is poking him in the thigh. He doesn't say anything, so I settle in, get comfortable, hug him back. We stand there for a long time. I don't let go until he lets go. Thank you. Next up, we have Manuel Gonzalez.
That was great. Thanks. Can everybody hear me? Am I speaking into the mic? I got the A-OK. I am speaking into the mic. You would think that I would know that because it's right in my face. So my name is Manuel Gonzalez. You know this because it's been said like 5 times, but I always feel obliged to tell people my name every time I stand up in front of them. It's a neuroses, maybe. So thank you guys for coming out, for braving the perhaps ill weather and dangerous cyclists speeding by. I don't know. I think they're maybe on lap. They're maybe on lap two. They have two. It's over. The women's is over, but the men's is about to start. Oh, so we have time. Good. That gives me time to put on my racing outfit. Actually, I did one of those the Surreys over at Minnehaha Park, and that killed me. That was like the worst idea I've ever had, is putting my family in one of those and thinking that I could motor them anywhere. So I'm not gonna do that again. So I'm gonna read from the regional office is under attack, which seems obvious. Again, I'm Mr. Obvious tonight. What if I just read from some random book behind me? So the regional office, if you don't know anything about the novel, The Regional Office is a secret organization that trains at-risk young women to fight the forces of darkness as they threaten the planet at every turn. And then one day it is under attack, as the name implies. And what there are two main characters that are followed throughout the story. Sarah, who has a rumored supposed mechanical arm, who works for the Regional Office, is defending it. And Rose, who is recruited by the people who want to bring down the Regional Office, and is part of the team attacking it. And it goes back and forth between their stories. What I'm going to read from is Rose, from when she is recruited and first brought to the training camp, where she learns to harness her innate powers and learns to be like some crazy master assassin. But before I do, I'm going to make sure that I have the pages marked the right way. Last time I forgot to mark them and I had to jump around. Jump around, get up, and get down. All right. When Rose first arrived at the compound, she'd been expecting things to be different. She'd been expecting it to be like The Karate Kid, maybe, where she would be taken in by a lovable, if befuddled and frail, old man who would, at a crucial point, reveal himself to be neither of those, befuddled, frail, but instead a subtle and powerful fighting machine and mentor who would ultimately provide the love and wisdom of an otherwise absent parent. She would spend weeks performing a number of mundane, idiotic, useless tasks, sweeping the already swept floor, cleaning the pristine toilet bowl, making fried egg sandwiches, which he would then refuse to eat, I'm allergic, which would reveal themselves to be mysterious but powerful kung fu poses, sweeping the floor, cleaning the toilet, frying the egg. Or if not that, then like an officer and a gentleman, but without the gentleman bit. Her, pitted against the hard-ass drill sergeant, she'd be the spitfire who constantly mouthed off and who would ultimately reveal herself to be pitted against her inner demons. Not the drill sergeant at all, who would prove herself foolhardy but full of bravado and in the process develop a bond with her fellow trainees, becoming in their eyes an example of what not to do, of how not to act, but also, in the end, by the end of boot camp or whatever this place was, becoming for them also an example of a hard battle fought and won with difficulty, tenacity, and through her indomitable spirit and unfathomable skill. Hell, she would have taken the parent trap even, warring factions of girls at summer camp who were so similar in nature and looks, strengths and weaknesses, all of them hemmed in by a male-dominated world that strove to limit their power and strength, that their first instinct was to undermine the force they could have become if only they worked together. But finally they would be brought together by the threat of some other big bad outside of themselves. Maybe something more threatening than a really bad thunderstorm and more like a drug-dealing camp counselor or something, but whatever, that. She would have been happy to have experienced that upon the arrival at the compound. What she hadn't expected, though, and what she couldn't quite handle, was the sense of overwhelming indifference that had been waiting for her when she arrived. She had been the last girl recruited, and no one had been expecting her, and they didn't seem to care that she was there. After nearly a month of training, the training had not been going well. The martial arts instructor spent hour after hour sweeping her feet out from under her and throwing her over his shoulder and trying to explain to her poses and moves and counter moves that she didn't understand at all, and whose names she couldn't remember. Lost monkey, wooden monkey, the broken faucet. None of those meant the first goddamn thing to her. And she was a disaster at languages, couldn't master even the simple phrases she was asked to learn. Where is the gun hidden? How do I get to the basement level of this building? And she was fairly confident that if she were dropped into the wilds of Alaska or some other equally feral place with nothing but a rope and a hunting knife, she could survive there for a sum total of 5 minutes for all that she'd learned in survival training. The one thing she could do, thanks more to her cousins and uncles who were minor league pyromaniacs and owned more empty land than was good for them, was, in the parlance of her demolitions instructor, blow shit up. She trained all day, before breakfast and through lunch, and then again after dinner, but she wasn't making progress. She wasn't making any progress at all, it seemed. But not because she couldn't learn this shit. She was good at learning, but generally didn't care enough about the shit she was supposed to learn in school. Diagramming a sentence. Proving geometrical shapes that had long ago been proved. Of course it was a triangle. Why in the fuck did she need to prove to anyone, let alone herself, that that was a triangle? But here she was, faced with truly interesting shit to learn, and she'd hit a wall. She told herself she didn't know why, but she knew why. She was lonely, and she didn't like it here. She'd met the other girls, if briefly. They nodded at her and smiled at her and shook her hand firmly, too firmly, and welcomed her aboard. And maybe they gave each other looks. We do not have time for this bitch. Looks. Or maybe that was her imagination. All of this happened a week after she arrived, and after that she saw them in passing, sometimes in the bathrooms or in the hallways, usually as a group that seemed to have no room for one more. They were beautiful and older than her, and looked very much like a unit, like a complete whole that functioned perfectly, thank you very much, without her. Once she ran into one of them on her own, a girl named Colleen, who often wore pink shorts and a yellow tank top and had a boyish haircut that made her look French, who, when Rose had first seen her, she'd pegged as potential arch nemesis material. Rose imagined her mean girl style, at the head of the posse of other girls, terrorizing and torturing and humiliating newcomers, who would have them all throw their worst at Rose, only for Rose to stand strong against their onslaught, to show first through her unwillingness to back down, and then through unfathomable skill, that she was the natural leader, that she was the star of this moment. But Colleen hadn't yet paid a lick of attention to her. Rose ran into her in the weapons training module. Her weapons instructor had set up extra training time for her because she couldn't shoot for shit, which made no sense, none at all. Rose had grown up around hunting rifles and the occasional crossbow, her Uncle Artie. And while she'd never taken to hunting herself, she'd always been a decent shot. Had never shied away from guns, but every time she held a sidearm, a rifle, a shotgun, a semi-automatic in front of her weapons instructor, she choked. She didn't know. Flinched. Pulled left. Thought too much about what she was doing. And out of the corner of her eye, she could see the weapons specialist roll his eyes, sense him mentally counting down the seconds until lunch. It was her time in the module, but Colleen was in there already, shooting away, and Colleen didn't seem to have noticed her come in, didn't look like she would finish any time soon. But Rose didn't care, not really. And she was going to offer to let Colleen work with her if she wanted, because it would have been nice to have the company. Nice to talk to someone who wasn't yelling at her for forgetting the Chinese character for dead in the bathroom stall. But as soon as Colleen saw Rose waiting outside, she set her module down and packed her things and left with barely a nod as she walked by. The short of it was this. Rose was lonely, and it was affecting her work. And soon they were going to kick her out of assassin school. She knew it, and it was completely fucking stupid of her. So she didn't have friends. So she hadn't seen the woman in red since the day she was recruited. So what? So what if the story the woman in red had told her had prepared Rose for something very different from all of this, had included words like leader and hero and saving the world and fighting the good fight? She was a silly little girl, she told herself. She was a silly little girl, and she should just toughen up. She should toughen up and stop thinking about home and her mama and daddy and sister, mean old Gina and dumb old Patty. She should stop missing the way she had thought of herself when the woman in red first pulled her aside, first told her all about what she could become. She should stop all of this, but she couldn't. Rose was sitting on her bed thinking about this again when someone knocked on the door of her room. The entire time she'd been at this school, this place, no one had knocked on her door. "Who is it?" Rose asked, hopeful and suspicious all at once. She didn't honestly care who it was, except in the back of her mind she did worry it might be someone come to make her go back home. Colleen opened the door and poked her head inside and said, "Decent?" "I guess," Rose said, and then, feeling a little put off by this girl, who had not only opened her door but who was now standing inside the room without an invitation, she said, "I guess they don't teach you to knock first in assassin school?" "I did knock," Colleen said. "Well, I guess they don't teach you to wait for the hostess to invite you in at—" "Oh, fuck it," Rose said. "What do you want?" She didn't mean to sound this way, pissy and upset and on the verge of tears, real fucking tears. But she couldn't help herself. Someone had come to see her in her room for the first time in nearly 5 weeks, and she was fucking the whole thing sideways, she could tell, and she couldn't stop herself. I thought I locked the door. What, did you just break into my dorm room? The doors don't lock, Colleen said. House rules. My bad. I must have misplaced my assassin school handbook. That's not what this is, you know. Whatever. They're going to kick me out anyway. Tomorrow, maybe. Maybe, Colleen said. It's possible. You wouldn't be the first. Rose, who'd been looking at the dirt under her fingernails, looked up. There were 20 to start, Colleen said, when she knew she had Rose's attention. In fact, it's kind of amazing that they brought you here at all, as far along as we are, that is. Yeah, it's been a fucking blast. I'm sure they're as happy about it as I am. Well, maybe, Colleen said. Look, I know we're not friends, and you probably don't care what I think, but you're overthinking it. I've been watching you. You're trying too hard. You've got natural ability, or they wouldn't have brought you here. You've got it inside you, but you're not letting it out. And soon, you're right. Soon they're going to send you home. If they don't think you can cut it, they're going to send you back. Soon, like maybe tomorrow. Rose turned to look away. Colleen opened the door again. Rose stood up and sighed and said, "You're right." And then she said, "We're not friends, and I don't care what you think, so thanks." Colleen smiled. "Stick around and we will be friends. Trust me." And then she left before Rose could say, "Doubt it." So she yelled it as loud as she could at the closed door. Rose decided she'd be long gone before either of those could happen, becoming friends with Colleen or being kicked out. She knew, she could tell by the way they looked at her, her instructors, everyone, that maybe she'd been holding on by a thread, but that thread had snapped. And any minute, someone was going to show up at her door and tell her to pack her things and then take her back home. So that night, she packed her backpack and left her room. The hallway outside her room was dark and quiet. She assumed there would be video cameras monitoring the compound at night, but she figured that no one would be monitoring them actively. As she moved out of the wing of the building that contained the dorm rooms, she realized that there might be guards standing at the gate. But when she reached the guards, she didn't have to sneak past them. They, two of them, were crumpled on the floor, unconscious or dead. A trickle of blood running down the forehead of one, and at the sight of them, Rose stopped. And then she moved to the guards to see if they were alive, but then she saw the security monitor behind the desk, showing screen after screen of television snow, and she went there instead. It took her less than a minute to find and remove the device that was interfering with the signal. She shifted the screens from one wing to the next. Dorm rooms, too, including her own. The cameras were everywhere, apparently. But she didn't see anyone. In fact, she didn't see anyone at all. The girls' rooms showed screen after screen of empty rooms, beds unmade, rooms left in disarray. They'd been taken. Each and every one of them had been taken, wasn't anywhere inside the buildings. Someone had invaded the compound, had disabled the guards, had abducted the trainees, had done all of this, making hardly a sound. They had done all of this and had left her behind. Son of a bitch, she thought. Even the fucking bad guys, whoever they are, don't know I'm here. Or maybe they knew and just didn't give a shit because of how much I suck. God fucking damn it, she thought. She kicked the security desk hard enough to punch a hole through it with her foot, and then she grabbed her backpack and stormed out of the compound and went looking for the assholes who had left her behind. It wasn't an easy trail to pick up and follow, but she found it anyway and followed it almost 10 miles. By the time she found the camp, it was after 4 in the morning. She spotted 3 guards standing outside a large tent, and then another guard standing out a smaller tent 10 yards farther back. The large tent must have held the girls. Then a 5th guard came strolling into the camp light. They spoke, quickly and quietly. The boss was almost ready, the girls were secured, the truck was on its way, 15-20 minutes tops. Everything was moving on schedule, according to plan. Only after the fact did she realize they were speaking Russian. Well, fuck, she could speak Russian. Rose looked behind her at the path she'd taken to get here, considered how long it would be before she could get back to the compound, find anyone else, bring that person or whatever army she could muster back to this campsite. And then she thought of what she'd packed with her. Her dress, a couple of language books, her wedge sandals, a clicker pen she'd stolen from an office. No weapons, no gear. It shouldn't have been left to her, risking herself for these girls who hardly knew her, who could barely make the effort to smile at her anymore. This job should have been the job of someone else, anyone else. She sighed. She took a deep breath. Silently, she crept forward. Rose crept for 100 or so feet toward the camp where they were holding the girls, and then paused long enough to pick up a medium-sized branch and throw it in a high arc over the heads of the guards and over the large tent, waiting for it to crash into something on the other side, grabbed the guard's attention just long enough so that she could skitter across the flat, bright expanse separating her from the guards in the tent. She had three of them off their feet and flat on their backs, the spindle top move. Before the fourth knew she was even there, he lunged, she slipped through his lunge, thread the needle, caught him in his solar plexus with her knee as she passed by him, an afterthought, really, then, pivoting, threw her weight in the form of her elbow onto his back, heard the cough escape his mouth, but heard, too, the charge coming from her blind side, shifted her weight, right spun low, revolving door, crouching, and swept the fifth guard off his feet, heard the action of a semi-automatic from behind her again, and without thinking performed a zigzagging series of back handsprings, aerials, and flips so suddenly fast, so much faster than she thought she could be, that when she stopped and realized she was standing just inches away from the guard with the gun, she swooned a little from the head rush. But not so much she couldn't grab the rifle by its butt and shove it hard into the guy's nose and then take it from him. She spun around with the rifle ready to fire some too-close-for-comfort warning shots at the others, but they were gone. Well, two of them were gone. The other three were on the ground, breathing, but knocked out. The last one, the one with the now broken nose and no longer the rifle in his hands, stood up behind her, his right hand cupping the blood coming out of his nose, his left hand raised as if he were giving up. But she couldn't trust him, she decided, so she brained him again with the butt of the rifle. All in all, she figured it had taken her 5 minutes. She looked around the campsite, looked at the four men knocked out and on the ground at her feet. She looked at the rifle in her hands, and then she fainted. And that's where I'll stop. Thanks. So I'm happy to answer questions, or even have you ask questions of John. That was a great story, by the way, John. Thanks for that. That was funny and sad. Also, I can't imagine, usually I would think that somebody would put a fuck chair on Craigslist or something, right? Not just in a garage sale. Is that where you got yours? Well, I mean, that's where you know, Amazon or Craigslist is usually. Shipping fees, though, boy, they're a bitch. Oh, yes. So the question is, where did the premise for this story come from? I didn't have an idea of what I was doing when I first started writing it. I just had a guy who you didn't meet in that section, but he recruited Rose. But I just had him, that kind of slick, somewhat handsome, dark-suited kind of handler guy show up at a detention center where Rose was being held. I didn't know what, I just had this image and I had him like do his spiel of like, I'm going to tell you a story and this story is your story and it's going to change your life. But before he could finish his spiel, she smashed his foot, shoved him out of the way and tried to break out of the detention center. And he still was chasing her. And while he was chasing her, he was thinking, if this girl gets away from him, he's not going to hear the end of it from the other boys back at regional. And I was like, oh, I wonder what regional is. And then I just kept writing. And at one point, too, so he finally catches her and brings her to regional, which I still didn't know what it was at the time, except for that he was bringing her there and she was being recruited. But also he was completely disaffected with his job, because at the time I was writing it, I felt very disaffected with my job. And so he decided to just leave. Like, he put her on the elevator to go meet whoever she was supposed to meet, and he just walked away. But as he was walking away, he was thinking, well, you don't just walk away from regional I don't know why you wouldn't just walk away from, but it's a well-known fact. And he wondered who Regional might send after him. And he thought about a woman named Sarah, dark-haired Sarah, and then Sarah with the mechanical arm just came out. And I was like, oh, somebody in this story has a mechanical arm. And now I know the world. I felt like once I had that, I had an idea of what the world was, even if I didn't know what was going to happen within this world. And then I just kept writing and writing and then cutting and cutting and then writing more. So, yeah. Any other questions? That was a great question. Thanks. So the question, I'm repeating the question because I was asked to repeat the question into the microphones. Am I still in the microphone? I am still in the microphone. So the question is, with all of the assassins and magical powers and mechanical arms and the mystical stuff that happens in this book, how is it that this book didn't get slapped with a sci-fi or fantasy label? And how do I place myself within the genre wars? I declare the genre wars over. I feel like the genre wars. I don't know. There was a time where there was very strict realism that was going on in American literature. I think mainly American literature, but also maybe also British literature. But I feel like outside of those two realms, fiction was doing whatever it wanted to do. But what I tell people, I don't feel like really hardcore genre readers are going to necessarily buy into this initially, because there are a lot of specific rules to genre, to like hard sci-fi or hard fantasy, that I don't even pay attention to. I don't explain any of the science or the magic. I just refer to it as a way to create a world, and also as a way to explore the characters and the relationships that they have with each other and their own regrets and doubts and the bad things that happen to them. Although I love reading sci-fi and fantasy, I know that there, and I've met, I've read, responses from people who are like, my short stories were sometimes billed as kind of sci-fi or fantasy. And then you would see comments online like, this isn't sci-fi or this isn't fantasy. And I was like, well, no, it's a short story collection published by Riverhead Books. And this is a novel published by Riverhead Books, which is like they had the Booker Man Prize winner this past time. And they, Lauren Groff, Fates and Furies, they're a literary house. So I just have, I don't know, I have enough elements that people can think of it as speculative or sci-fi or fantasy, but also enough just character elements that I think push it more, like you can read it as either literary or sci-fi fantasy, but I'd prefer people just to read it. I don't care what they call it. just read it. As Jess Walter says on the cover. Although I was at a conference and somebody walked by the table that I was at. I was at a conference representing the University of Kentucky, and the copy of the book was there. And somebody was like, ooh, Jess Walter says read it. And then her snarky friend was like, or read it. Which, granted, is hilarious. Any other questions?
What was it like getting in the mindset of teenage girls for your story?
Well, I didn't, part of it comes from, I have a daughter, she's only 9, but like even from like when she was in first grade, she's just finished fourth grade, she was already experiencing this weird social dynamic in the playground and in school that I had no understanding of growing up as a boy, because we were like, we didn't have any social structure at all. It was like we were just whatever. And then, but there's like so much hierarchy and back and forth and I don't know, diplomacy that has to go on. It feels like, so I was fueled a little bit by that and trying to explore that. But then also I just felt, I don't know, maybe there's a bit of a teenage girl in me. I don't know. It didn't feel like, I mean, I felt like I had Rose as a character very early on in my head, and she's mouthy and snarky, and it's all as a cover-up, For whatever things she's actually worried about, like that she's going to be stuck living her parents' life in a small, she comes from a small town in North Texas, or, you know, that she's just, her whole life will be nothing but biding her time. And then after the regional office, when she's trying to pull together a life, that she thought that she'd wanted to escape this one life, but she threw herself into the wrong kind of thing, which are things that I think about all the time. You know, and I don't know that it's a gender thing. It's just, I don't know. These are the things that I worry about myself, like being stuck or having an idea in my head of what I want and working really hard to get it, only to realize once I've got it that it's not really, one, it didn't change my life in a way that I thought was going to change my life. Or even worse, it's like, oh, I didn't really want this. I just convinced myself that I want this, and now I have it. This like this job or this like this moment, and then I'm like, oh wow, that's too bad. Okay. And I would do like, and I do that like from, you know, big things to small things, where like being in charge of people, that sounds like a great thing, or running my own company, that sounds like something I totally would want to do, and then I do it, and I'm like, boy, that's a really crappy thing to do. I am also really bad at it. And so I guess that's kind of where she came from. I don't know. That's a bad answer. I didn't channel a teenage girl. I should have trapped a teenage girl in the house and had her write the lines for me. That's what I'm going to say from now on. Maybe not the trapped part. This is a podcast. I also used to run a nonprofit organization that worked with kids. So I don't know why they let me do that, considering half of the things I've said tonight. any other questions? I have no filter. Yeah.
Do you encourage students to write without an outline?
Well, yeah. What I tell students is that they should figure out what works best for them. Like, especially, I teach undergrad, a lot of undergrad students, most of whom don't want to be writers. They're taking my class because it satisfies a credit for them, but I really want them to take themselves as writers in that class, and I'm going to treat them that way. I want them to treat each other and themselves that way, but they're all scared of like, well, one, they always ask me, what is my paper supposed to be about? And I'm like, it's a story, not a paper, and anything. And it freaks them the hell out. And so I tell them, you know, like, writing into the dark, can make yourself comfortable with writing into the dark, not knowing exactly where you're going or what you're writing towards, then you will feel a lot better about this. But also, you might be the kind of person who has to outline things. I am not. But if you are, then you should outline something and try and pull it together. And I give them, you know, strategies, and I have them read enough good stories that they see how a story can work. And I run them through exercises, and they all do fairly well. I'm surprised constantly by these freshmen and sophomore students who have never written a piece of fiction before. But I always tell them, I always want people to follow whatever process works best for them. Because otherwise, if you're trying to, I remember I would read like Immovable Feast by Hemingway when I was right after college. And I was like, in order to write a good story, I need to be starving and drinking a lot of wine out of wineskins and taking up a table at a little cafe, drinking little demitasses. I don't even know what those are, but I'm going to do it. And that's going to make me a better writer. And then after a while, I was like, I'm just really broke and all my stories just suck. So then after a while I finally figured out, your process should be your process, and you can ape other people's processes, but it's not necessarily going to do anything for you. But it is a way to try out, well, maybe getting up every day at 7 a.m. and writing for 3 hours is the way I have to do it. Or maybe I can only write starting at 11 p.m, writing until 2. Like a friend of mine does that. He writes from 11 until 1 or 2 a.m. And I know that I could, like, after 7, I'm brain dead and ready to just watch The Voice or Psych or just anything that I can just turn my mind off. But he doesn't really start percolating until after 10:30 or 11. So I think, but I can't write with an outline because I feel like I'm not discovering anything. Like, that's what I like about the writing, is discovering the characters and discovering the story.
Did your other books work the same way?
Well, I have a collection of stories that came out before this. And those, yeah, I would have just an idea and I wouldn't know where it was going to go. Like, oh. Well, one of the stories has a unicorn in it. And we were driving with my daughter. The story came about. We stopped at a McDonald's and there was a Beanie Baby unicorn that she got. And it was when she was about 2 or 3. And she... asked us what's the name of the unicorn, and we looked and it was like, oh, it's Fable. And she was like, oh, I don't really like that name. And in my mind, I was like, I don't like that name either. I would name, if I had a unicorn, I would name it Saber Bitch. And then I thought to myself, or maybe just Saber because of the kids. And once I had that, I was like, oh, I wonder what would happen if I had a unicorn. And then I was like, oh, what would be even better? I wonder what would happen if my best friend from high school, who I'm now kind of not friends with, but we continue to be friends because we feel like we have to, what if he got the unicorn? And then I was really pissed about it. And that's how it just kept going. Like, so that was a really, I don't even know if you asked a question. I just started talking. My apologies. I hope that answers all of your problems. Any other, or should we, I mean, we have to get our suits on, at least the men in the house have to get our bikes ready and our suits on. Are there any other questions? Thanks, guys. I appreciate you coming out, laughing when you were supposed to laugh. It's nice. And thanks again to Majors and Quinn and to John, for coming out and supporting me and reading with me. I appreciate it very much. Thanks, guys.